The claim was we built a gauge invariant and non-local operator by the formula and then this was multiplied by z1m^4 and then divided by so this was the expression we wrote, and we claimed that this expression was a gauge invariant thing on twister space, and we noted its similarity to the Park-Taylor formula. So why is this gauge invariant? Let me just remind you. So the gauge variation, there was two terms. Replace any field, B, R, A, by chi, say, and the second thing that can happen is replace A, say, Zi by d bar chi ci. And we saw when we do that, because of the presence of these expressions in the denominator, that was equivalent to multiplying chi by the neighboring expressions in the trace. So this sends something like A ci minus 1, a ci plus 1. To a ci minus 1 chi ci minus 1 AZI plus 1. Minus. Okay. And we'd have something similar if these A's on the outside would be, so it would be the same thing. And the claim was, this is set up but these two terms cancel. So I hope that's reasonably clear. We have a string which goes A, there's B, A, this kind of thing, and it goes in a circle.
That's how we should think about it. Maybe these are all A's. And either I replace each term by a commutator, or I bring this guy to hit that one minus bring that to hit that one. And that's the same. Because for each, if I look at what happens to this one, if the A over here comes to hit it, or the A over here comes to hit it, they have opposite signs, so it's a commutator. Okay, so why is this the Park-Taylor formula? And what has this got to do with scattering amplitudes? So to explain this, I need to explain the spinner helicity formalism, which is a really kind of fundamental way of thinking about scattering amplitudes. And I expect you guys have not seen it before, have you? No, okay. So, if we have a massless particle, has momentum P, I'm going to treat it as being in C4. So I want to analytically continue for now with P dot P equals 0. So we'll use the kind of spinner indices where my momentum is parameter is P alpha alpha dot. And P dot P is P alpha alpha dot P beta beta dot epsilon alpha beta epsilon alpha dot beta dot. Okay, so this this very cool fact that if I have a null momentum in only in dimension 4, so for any such P, there exist a pair of spinners lambda alpha, lambda tilde, alpha dot, so that P alpha alpha dot is lambda alpha, lambda tilde, alpha dot. So this pair of spinners is defined, it's unique up to rescaling this one in one way and rescaling this one in the opposite way. So if I wanted to explain this fact to a mathematician who might have studied algebraic geometry, you would say, well, this equation, if I take this guy up as a, not as a vector, but up to scaling, P is a point in CP3, and this equation cuts out a quadric in CP3, and every quadric in CP3 is a product of two CP1s. And that's what this says. The point in the quadric is a product of two CP1s. So this is very special to dimension 4, and it's tied up with the fact that the group SO4 is the symmetries which preserve a quadric in CP3, and therefore is this product of SL2 times SL2.
A quadric is the word?
Quadric. It's a very math, 19th century math term. Yeah. It's solution, projective solutions of a quadratic homogeneous equation. So you can ask, if I choose guys like this, why is this expression null?
This is epsilon alpha beta. And this is symmetric, because these are numbers. And this is anti-symmetric. So that's 0. OK, so the spinner helicity notation is the following. So amplitudes. Are going to be SO4. Imagine we're computing scattering amplitudes of n massless particles scattering in some way. They're going to be SO4 invariant. Quantities, say functions. Of P1, Pn, which satisfy Pi dot Pi equals 0. So therefore, we can view them as functions of two n spinners. And here, instead of being SO4 invariant, we can think of them as being SL2 times SL2 invariant. Where one SL2 transforms the lambdas, and the other the lambda tildes. Now, you've looked at amplitudes a little bit, right? Have you? So probably you talked about you might look at the Mandelstam invariance or something. Have you seen that? Yeah.
We actually talked about it very little in SI.
Really? Okay. Okay. Well, anyway. I was going to say the Mandelstam invariants are not a complete set of such things. There are many more. Only for four external particles or something. Are they good enough? What kind of things can I build? Well, I can take lambda I alpha, lambda j beta, epsilon alpha beta is SL2 invariant. And similarly, lambda tilde I alpha dot, lambda tilde I beta dot, epsilon alpha dot beta dot is also SL2 say tilde invariant. So the notation is this is ij and this is square brackets ij. So the complete set of quantities we can build are functions
have ij and ij. Okay. Now, there's one more constraint. My momentum was this product of lambda and lambda tilde, and we had this kind of gauge symmetry where I could scale one, scale the other in the opposite way. This would be a tilde. So that tells us, so we can do this kind of gauge symmetry independently for each I. So that tells us we're not going to be able to find an arbitrary function. So we're never going to be able to find a 1, 2 on its own. But there's some kind of rule for how many times this can appear and how many times this can appear. So that rule is the following. To respect the symmetry, scaling each lambda I by ci and lambda tilde I by 1 over ci, we need the following. This is for a scalar field. Each I, let's see, the total number of I somethings is equal to the total number of bracket I somethings. So there's actually, I'm not going to go into all the details for a gauge field, but this rule changes slightly for a gauge field. You have total weight equals something, depending on the helicity.
Sorry, Professor. I didn't fully understand this last argument. So I know that, okay, I understand there's this for every I, there's the scaling symmetry. So that means we have to build scalar to build in varying quantities. We have a constraint on how many of them can of these pairs can appear.
Yeah. So we can't have. It's not we're not allowed to have an ij by itself, because when I scale it, this would become ci cj.
Okay. That's.
But you could have
this divided by.
Yeah. Like ij over jk k something or whatever. I mean. It's possible to build things for which the total number vanishes.
And why must the quantity respect the scaling, the invariant quantity?
Because the physical quantity I have is the momentum, not these lambdas. You can't build lambda from the momentum. You can only build this pair up to simultaneous rescaling.
Okay. Since the p doesn't see the rescaling. Whatever quantity we built should end up being.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. This is like this because every particle has helicity zero?
Yes, this is for a scalar field, exactly. But if you were to do it for a gauge field,
is there an intuitive way for understanding?
Of understanding?
Like why how the helicity is related to this, because in our, like when we were working with Freddy, we always knew like the overall weight that
yes.
we have, because we had a scattering of like n particles with three negative helicity,
mm-hmm.
so we knew the weight.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the way he explained that to us was about like a gauge symmetry of the matrices we were integrating.
Mm-hmm.
So,
no, there is. Let me try and explain this. So. Yeah, I'm just trying to remember. So if you have a gauge field, so as state of momentum P, should be something like, and say, of say negative helicity is something like this. A gauge field with F plus equals zero and F minus being like E P dot X times some thing here. And this is some expression. So, you know, all I'm saying is that if I want to give a gauge field, you don't just give a function, you have a tensor. And this tensor has a bunch of components, and those components also transform under the Lorentz group. So what happens is that these lambdas appear here as well. And amplitudes, people have some weird name for what this thing is. So how do we build such a thing? So given spinners, lambda, lambda tilde, we can set F minus equals E to the lambda alpha, lambda tilde, alpha dot, x alpha alpha dot. So this is how we spell your usual plane wave in this notation. And over here, F minus, say minus gamma delta, this is the expression, and we notice that this is supposed to be symmetric, and this is symmetric too. And similarly, F plus gamma dot delta dot equals E . So we need to check that this satisfies the appropriate equations, like the Young-Wills equation.
Is this some sort of basis for the?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, given the spinners, we can build a negative velocity state and a positive velocity state, and those are separate pieces of the Hilbert space. And each one, this is a basis of the negative velocity state. This is a basis of the positive velocity Hilbert space. The Young-Wills equation, for F minus, is that d by dx F minus, and how do we do this?
X have another index, I
yes, thank you. So this was the equation. And I want to say it's now just comes down to some symmetry thing. You know, if I differentiate, let's do it explicitly. So this is equal to epsilon beta gamma. I differentiate with respect to x beta beta dot. This will say the same. I'm going to bring down lambda beta dot. I also have lambda gamma, lambda delta. This is equal to 0 for symmetry. Because this is anti-symmetric, and this is symmetric. So similarly for the positive velocity state. So for any of these, you know, also it's also true for gravitons. In any of these situations, you can build a solution of the free field equations from a pair of spinners, and it always takes this form. Here, this is spin one. I have two spinners here. Was gravitons, it would be spin two, there'd be four spinners coming out like that. And that tells you, you know, everything. The appearance of you can figure out how things scale under this gauge symmetry by looking at these by looking at how f plus and f minus depend on lambda and lambda tilde.
These quantities see the scaling. Is that a problem? Should we remove that? That depends on the scaling of lambda tilde and lambda.
Well, what's happening if I have an external?
We have to contract, and so that'll cancel it.
No, you think if I have an external state of negative velocity, then I get a scaling plus one for every on that variable. And if I have an external state of positive velocity, you get a scaling of minus one on that variable.
Yeah, and that's okay.
That's okay. The amplitude will have that property. Yeah. Yeah.
Can we obtain this expression from the contour integral solutions we had for?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to do that later today. So these expressions can be lifted to some simple expressions on twister space too.
Decomposition is only valid on shell?
Yes, but we're scattering on shell states, so yes. Also only in massless theories. So if we say that I has weight 1 and brackets has weight minus 1, if we're scattering gluons, and the ith external state is of positive velocity, or say negative velocity, then we have total weight 2. And if it's positive velocity, we have weight minus 2. And that's just because of the lambdas and lambda tildes appearing up there. And this agrees with what Freddy said, right? So for example, this is the Park-Taylor formula. If at tree level,
if we scatter two states of negative helicity and n minus 2 of positive helicity, the amplitude is the following expression. Where, well, let's see. Let me write this a bit more carefully. So where are these T's? If this is the matrix in GLN, or UN, for the ith state. Okay, so the way I've written it is a little complicated. It's complicated only because when things scatter, the way I contract these gauge indices can be done in any order, and I have to take into account all those orderings, which is why I'm summing over the permutations. But here we see the same thing we found before. So as before. And I hope you can also see that the weights are what we said they were. Because if 1, 2 are the negative helicity states, so I get a weight of 4 from the top, and they have each state appears twice on the bottom. So the total weight of the negative helicity states is 2, and the total weight of the positive ones is minus 2.
Some over non-cyclic permutations because of the
trick. Yeah, that's just a factor of 1 over
n. Not for UN, is it?
The summing over cyclic are, I mean, this expression is cyclically invariant and so is this. So that's just an overall factor of 1 over n. So it doesn't really matter. To explain how, so we have these expressions for these states. It's a basis with the Hilbert space, and it's a nice way to write scattering amplitudes. I want to explain how to lift them to twister space.
So we know any solution of the free field equations comes from something on twister space. So how do we make this kind of thing explicit? The answer is extremely easy. Basically, we write lambda, this spinner, as 1, comma z. So the state of momentum P alpha alpha dot, say lambda lambda tilde, it's just I take the delta function at z. Let me sort this as z naught. And then e to the lambda tilde it's simply this quantity. This is a zero one form. This would be a dz bar here. I can treat it as a 0-1 form on twister space with coefficients in O(n) for any n, just by multiplying it by an appropriate power of dz. Okay. Can you guys parse this expression? Does it make sense to you?
Well,
it's not quite, because I'm not doing a delta function on the circle. And here I'm just doing a delta function at a point. So let's draw a picture. This is my CP1. And twister space is this kind of vector bundle over it. My state lives at this point. There's many ways of representing it, but this is the most natural one. Now, how do we know that it gives back the state we wrote? Let's just do this for a scalar field. Let's take n equals minus 2. Why does this give? E to the lambda alpha, lambda tilde, alpha dot, x alpha alpha dot. The reason, the way we translate between twister space and space-time, we integrate, right? So if we're going to integrate over z, e lambda tilde alpha, and here u alpha plus z u hat alpha dot is beta. So the rules we had was we integrate, well, remembering the relationship between the v coordinates and the u coordinates, So this integral just means I set z equals z naught.
Geometrically, I'm not seeing the picture that you
have. Mm-hmm. The way I'm thinking about it is, you know, I want to realize a plane wave like this on space-time. Why don't I just go through the rest of the argument and then might clarify things. So you want to say that E lambda tilde beta, say alpha dot, you said not, Z not, sorry. Is equal to E to the lambda alpha lambda tilde alpha dot x alpha dot. So now the key point is that lambda is 1 comma z naught.
And the left exponent, everything is contracted with epsilon, right? Epsilon alpha.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Epsilon beta.
Yeah.
The U has a beta dot instead of R beta.
Sorry, thank you, yes. And for some reason here, I decided, let me lower these indices again. It doesn't really matter. So everything looks the same. The point is, there's a Z here, and that Z is this one. So this kind of one Z naught that's implicit here is that. So we can make it really explicit by saying that x1 alpha dot is u alpha dot, x2 alpha dot. Maybe I got this backwards. I think I got this backwards. 1 alpha dot is u hat alpha dot. So this is the coordinate change between, you know, how we write the x and u coordinates. They're related in this simple way. So lambda alpha x beta beta dot epsilon alpha beta is something like, maybe it's minus if I just contract with the lambdas, I get this thing with 1 and z naught. And then I contract with the lambda tildes. OK, so now I've said this. Let's think about what's going on. Let's look at this expression here. So we've written a plane wave, but the exponent only involves certain coordinates. It involves the coordinates which are holomorphic in the complex structure associated to z naught. Remember, a point in this CP1 parameterizes a complex structure. So it picks out a pair of coordinates. Um, So the geometric picture I have is I take my plane wave. The plane wave is holomorphic in a certain complex structure. And then I can represent it in twister space by a delta function at that complex structure times a plane wave on twister space. Does that clarify things? No?
Can you do a ride also?
See, I here's my twister space, and I have this point, and I have a delta function. And here's this plane. On this plane, I have a plane wave. And then I want to go down to space-time. And the way I go down to space-time is by averaging over the CP1.
Where is the CP1 here? Is that all twister space or?
This in this picture?
In this picture, yeah, where's?
That's the CP1.
Okay. That circle, that's your, the copy of CP1 on top.
And this is like my point Z0. And then at Z0, I have a plane wave moving in the other two variables. Because I had, you know, e to the v times the delta function.
Okay.
That's my plane wave in the other two variables. And the way I go from twister space to space-time is I average over the CP1. And that does nothing up here, but it just picks up this plane wave.
So somehow we copied the plane wave we had below, and we attached it at a specific z.
Mm-hmm. I mean, going from here to here, like, we know how the coordinates here are related to those up here. Like, v is a linear combination of u and u hat. So all we've done is we've taken the plane wave here and wrote it in the coordinates for this space. That's all. So as another kind of, so we've checked this for a scalar. Maybe it might be possible exercise. I should email Giuseppe. So can you repeat this analysis for a gauge field? And you should find that f minus should be e to the stuff in the usual way times lambda lambda, like we did before. So you should find the rules of turning something on twister space, which is a section of O minus 4, into an f minus in spacetime will bring up these guys. We're almost at being able to say, why does this formula, Lionel-Mason, about the holomorphic Wilson line, you know, he had this formula which is just forced by gauge invariance in twister space, and why is it really the same thing as the Park-Taylor formula? So what we need to do, we take the holomorphic, we're going to take the holomorphic Wilson line, and replace the ith external state by a delta function, z equals zi, e to the lambda tilde I, because this will correspond to state determined by lambda I equals 1 zi and lambda tilde . All right, so in other words, when I take these spinor helicity states and I want to put them on twister space, you have these delta functions. So when I look at the holomorphic Wilson line, I want to have my external states be given by these expressions. So remember, the holomorphic Wilson line was this kind of expression. And then we have some kind of sum. So now, when my external state is a delta function in the z variable, well, I'm integrating over z, and the delta function and the integrals just cancel with each other. So that means I'm just evaluating at zi. So, well, if we do it carefully, there's going to be a sum of permutations. Which I will, you know, be a bit lazy about. And we'll only look at one of the terms. The point is, you know, this state. Sorry, I called two different things z. Sorry. This state could be evaluated at any one of these things, but let's assume they're ordered.
Okay. Wait.
Yeah.
One thing, like, what we call a holomorphic Wilson line was the piece we had to add before to make the action of the Yang-Mills, the full Yang-Mills action.
Exactly, yes.
We call a holomorphic Wilson line.
Exactly, yes.
And what are we doing now? Sorry, like we're...
So we want to perform a scattering, study a scattering process in Yang-Mills theory. So I have to add this term to the action on twister space. And then I want to see, this term is some kind of integral where I have a bunch of points over CP1 and I'm integrating over their positions. And then I have these external states, which are delta functions. So the scattering process amounts to inserting these delta functions for these A's and B's.
Okay.
Like, it's that operator in the presence of these external states. Yeah.
The external states that we are using are scalar?
No, so it's... We're always, you know... The amount of information in like a negative helicity state for gauge theory is the same as the amount of information for one scalar. It's a lambda and a lambda tilde. It's just in code, so we're always using this game where on twister space, the components of the tensor are a little hidden. When I go back down to spacetime, I pick up the F has a lambda lambda beside it. What we did earlier, or it's erased. Remember, F was like e to the p dot x lambda lambda. So we're using those states. But the twister representative of those states is very simple.
Yeah, I'm failing to fully grasp how the scattering is working here. Like, it's not the usual way I'm used to seeing scattering. Like, I want some broths and some cats. It's an operator in the middle and some perturbation theory or something. And somehow this is related to that. But I'm failing to see. Is there an easy way to see how this is mapping into that, or what are we doing? Or maybe how to frame it other scattering in this language. I'm failing to bridge the two.
Yeah, and yeah, I certainly agree there are some steps which I'm missing. So what, if we're very careful about what we're doing, we're really studying a form factor. Yeah, since this is important, maybe I'll have to just get to it next time. Get to that. So on space-time, we have integral b which f, integral b squared times Yang Mills squared. And this is equivalent to Yang Mills action. Okay. So what we're studying the scattering in the presence of the local operator trace b squared at a point at the origin in R4. So this is not quite the same thing, but once I integrate over its position, it will become the same thing. So if this vertex is going to denote the local operator, in self-dual Yang Mills, let me quickly draw the Feynman rules for self-dual Yang Mills. This is a B. The propagator goes from negative velocity to positive velocity, and the vertex looks like this. So in space-time, we're studying we have this operator. This kind of thing. And maybe these guys can go off like that too. So this is the kind of quantity we're studying in space-time. So it's some sum over Feynman diagrams. The point is, all of these diagrams are encoded in the gauge invariants on twister space. So on twister space, this thing becomes the gauge invariant thing what it looks like. some big sum. And these terms are the same as in the code, the Feynman diagrams. So, okay. Oh, let me see. I'm not going to be able to totally convince you, I think, but an absolutely key point is the following. So if I'm in space-time, like, why do I get something like this? My particles can come in, my two particles there, and they can interact with each other, form something else, interact with something else, and I get some complicated mess. So on twister space, that process is not possible, because my particles just live at different points, and they just slide past each other, and they never see each other at all. Right? They live at, there's a delta function at different points, and they just are invisible to each other. So on twister space, all of the complications are encoded instead in the in this vertex. So instead of having particles scattering off each other, the particles just slide past each other but bounce off this complicated thing in the middle. And that's why the formula works. Yeah.
But the states are always of self-dual Young Mills, not of Young Mills.
They have the same kinematics. So in each case, the states are described by something of positive elasticity, something of negative elasticity. They just have different dynamics.
So we started with a self-dual Young Mills Lagrangian, and we ended up with Young Mills Lagrangian plus b squared term. You said we can drop off the b squared because it does not have kinetic terms. Is that only on shell? Because
no. Once the Young, there's some slightly delicate process of like being careful with the size of the Young Mills coupling. But if the Young Mills coupling is not zero, you can integrate it out. But we don't want to, you know, so that's how you connect to full Young Mills. But to make this argument work, it's much better to have it in this framework. So I want to view the process as self-dual Young Mills in the presence of an operator.
Okay, so we'll, instead of dropping out that term, we'll work with it, and we want it to be gauge invariant. And
yes.
In order to have gauge invariance, we are adding these extra terms.
Exactly, on twister space, yes.
These give us some extra diagrams.
Yes. And like they, yeah, the ones I'm drawing here on twister space, they're the ones we worked out explicitly, and they are the same as what you would get by computing those Feynman diagrams in space time.
Well, instead of saying that they give us more diagrams, I would have said that like a bunch of diagrams are going to be encoded in a single vertex of random.
Yes, absolutely.
Like you just need to count the number of external legs and use the one with the
appropriate. Absolutely. So it's kind of remarkable, right? Because if you were to do this on spacetime, it would be a hideous mess. And in fact, when Park Taylor first came up with it, they couldn't even prove it. They just did some computations and guessed. And it wasn't not, I think it took some people some work to actually prove it. So.